Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The news and social media have been dominated by the coronavirus pandemic over the past month and a half. Much of it has been informative and accurate, but there are some stories that may not be as trustworthy. Something we've noticed on Smart Talk is that many of you still have health or medical related questions about the COVID-19 virus. On today's program, as we've done once a week for the past month or so, we feature a medical professional to answer your questions. Joining us today is Dr. David Gasparak, Vice President and Regional Medical Director with WellSpan Medical Group. Dr. Gasparak, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment about COVID-19, this is your opportunity to ask that question. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Gasparak, I'm curious, what question are you being asked most often over the past month since this started?
The most common question we're getting is, what do I do if I feel like I'm getting symptoms? So, you know, the main symptoms of COVID-19 are fever, cough, shortness of breath, and people are wondering what to do when they get one of those symptoms. And instinctively, I think we all go to seek care, whether we show up at an urgent care, we go to our primary care office. And that's really not what you want to do at this point. What you want to be doing is making that first contact by phone to call into your primary care office or to call into an online urgent care so that you can be triaged to the best site that can take care of you. Before just showing up. Because if you show up to a lot of these places now, they're going to screen you to see if you have COVID symptoms and then suggest that you go home and make that phone call.
Are you still having patients show up at the WellSpan facilities?
We are. Fortunately, at this point, since we have community spread, we are doing active screening at all of our hospital entities and at all of our ambulatory sites. So if you show up, you'll be greeted by one of our employees wearing a mask saying, do you have fever? Do you have new onset cough, new onset shortness of breath? And if you do, they're going to recommend that you either call your family physician or you call our COVID hotline.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I should have included in that question is showing up without calling ahead. You're still seeing that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not as common. I mean, I think the message is getting out that we're telling people to call first. But there's still some fear when people get these symptoms and they want to be cared for quickly. So there are still some showing up, yes.
Any idea how many patients WellSpan has treated who have tested positive?
Well, I can tell you that to date we have almost 10,000 tested and about 600 have come back positive. To give an exact number of how many have been treated, I can't really say, but that's about a 6% positive rate within all of our WellSpan entities.
Have you had any fatalities?
Yes, we have.
Mm. So we've already received some questions from listeners, and Andrea asked, I'm curious if the pneumonia vaccine offers any protection if the coronavirus attacks the lungs.
The pneumonia vaccine will not offer protection. Pneumonia vaccine is specific for the bacteria pneumonia. COVID is a different organism. It's a virus. It's actually a novel coronavirus. So that would not offer protection.
Well, let me follow up on that a little bit, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but pneumonia, if someone is predisposed to pneumonia, that would seem to be a pre-existing condition, that if they've gotten pneumonia several times and they get a pneumonia shot that keeps them from getting pneumonia, wouldn't that offer some protection since pneumonia is, you would be more susceptible to the COVID-19 virus?
All right. So pneumonia is somewhat of a generic term, just meaning infection in the lungs. And that pneumonia shot is specific to one type of infection in the lungs. Yes, I agree with you that having a previous pneumonia in the past does predispose you to getting a pneumonia in the future. But again, the pneumonia vaccine will not protect you against coronavirus pneumonia.
Let's take a phone call from Mary in Harrisburg. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a type 2 diabetic, and I've been hearing that diabetics are susceptible to this virus, but they never distinguish between type 1 and type 2. And my life experience is that my friends with type 1 are susceptible to many more medical conditions that I've never had. So my question is, are type 2s as susceptible as type 1s?
So both type 1 and type 2 have technically have compromised immune systems. So yes, there is a degree of being more susceptible. The other issue with diabetes is that it is one of the risk factors for having complications of COVID. So you hear about age, high blood pressure, diabetes, underlying heart conditions, and underlying lung conditions. They're all risk factors that if you do contract COVID, you have a higher chance of developing complications from the COVID.
Mary, I understand you also have Addison's disease?
Yes, and that gives me a low immune system, similar to the people with lupus, but the medication I'm on is different. It's hydrocortisone, but I'm wondering if that will protect me the way the medications that lupus people take protect them.
So the medication that's been referred to in the media is hydroxychloroquine, which is very different from hydrocortisone. Hydrocortisone is a steroid, so it would not offer the same protection that the hydroxychloroquine may be offering some of our COVID patients.
You know, Mary asked a question I've been wondering about for a few weeks now. We have heard that those who are diabetic are more susceptible, but I was also wondering about the diabetes 1, diabetes 2. You know, just for those who may not be sure, diabetes 1 is the genetic, something that you're born with, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And diabetes 2 is something that your what you eat, how you eat, obesity, weight, those kind of things can all contribute to. So I'm a little curious, again, without getting too much in the weeds, why both 1 and 2 would be susceptible?
Right. So type 1 is more of a lack of insulin production from the pancreas, and that's, like you said, something that's usually earlier onset, often in childhood, but sometimes not until adulthood, whereas type 2 is more of an insulin sensitivity. So it's not that your body's not producing insulin, it's that the receptors in your body don't recognize it as insulin anymore. And like you said, that is usually from things like obesity, more lifestyle-related than genetic. But from what we've seen so far, whether it's type 1 or type 2, it does seem to make you more susceptible to COVID.
Mm. Selena from Camp Hill asks, what is the safest filter material for DIY home mask?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, what I can say is that on our wellspan.org, so www.wellspan.org, we have a COVID information on there, and there's a tab that says, I want to help. And under that I want to help section, there's instructions on how to make masks. There's a pattern on there, and there should be instructions on there and what kind of materials are considered the best.
We have another listener ask a question, and this is a good one, too. Most of the attention since social isolating has been on the COVID-19 virus. With all of us practicing social distancing, has there been any statistics on the effects social distancing has had on the flu, strep throats, colds, etc.?
Yeah, I think there's been so much concentration on the COVID numbers at this point. I mean, at least three times a day, we're all looking at our WellSpan numbers, Department of Health numbers. I don't think we've taken a step back yet to look at how this has affected other communicable diseases like flu and strep. I think that's something we'll do after we get over the hump, and something that is going to teach us a lot about the benefits of social distancing. I just don't think we're there yet.
You know, one of the things that just an observation, maybe a correct one or an incorrect one, but it seems as though, and I'm making this observation based on what I see in social media and hearing people say, but today in this atmosphere, when people are exhibiting signs of the flu or a cold, a cough, you know, especially a dry cough, maybe a fever, that their thoughts right away are going to COVID-19 rather than the flu or a cold. Have you observed that at all?
Well, unfortunately, at this point, that is somewhat appropriate. So we have community spread, meaning that you do not have to have a close contact with a confirmed positive case in order to be considered at risk. Anyone at this point with community spread is considered at risk. So if you do develop a fever, or if you do develop new onset cough or new onset shortness of breath, your first thought should be COVID, and you should be getting tested.
Mm. Another question from a listener. Are we being told to wear masks to protect us from contracting the virus or to passing the virus because we might be asymptomatic?
So the masks that are being recommended to wear around in public are more to protect others from what you might be putting out. So I think it's more the second, that even though you might not have symptoms at this time, you are symptomatic about 2-3 days before you develop symptoms. So if you go to the supermarket or to the gas station, when you wear a mask, you're protecting those around you from whatever you might be giving off. However, if you come in contact with someone that is COVID positive that is not wearing a mask, those masks that we're using in the public would not offer a lot of protection for you.
And I think that's been the directive from the Pennsylvania Department of Health, too, is that this is to keep you from when you sneeze or you cough, that you're spreading the disease. Alicia from Middletown says, my granddaughter was born last Friday. I have not traveled the 90-minute drive north to meet her yet. Is it safe for me to do so? If not, when would be a safe time? That may be a question, may be difficult to answer, but what about the first one?
So what was the first question?
The first one was about is it safe for her to make the 90-minute drive to go meet her granddaughter?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. We're encouraging people to stay home as much as possible. Again, without knowing Amanda, I don't know what her risk factors are, if she has underlying medical conditions or not. I would say at this point we're in the ramp-up phase where we're going to start to see more and more positive cases and more community spread. So the safest thing to do at this point is to stay home.
So you think we're still in the ramp-up stage?
I do.
Why do you think that?
We're following many different models. Right now we're following the CHIME model from Penn. It's hard to predict. You know, we hear what's going on nationally and their predictions, and it's hard to translate what that will look like in South Central Pennsylvania. But it looks like we haven't hit our peak in any of the markets around here just yet.
You know, I was just saying to someone this morning that we're getting some mixed signals, though.
Yeah.
The Philadelphia Inquirer the last 2 days has had stories about the Philadelphia city officials thinking that they may have seen the worst of it and that there is some reason for optimism. Mm-hmm. But yet, Vice President Pence made a point of saying the next hotspot will be Philadelphia. And one of the first things I thought of is, you know, we're only 100 miles from Philadelphia. We're very close here in South Central Pennsylvania, if that indeed is a hotspot or if it has passed the ramp-up stage.
Right. I mean, all I can say locally at this point is that we are tracking the numbers daily. And we have not gotten to a point where we've seen the curve flatten yet. And based on how different all these models are, at this point, we're still in the preparing for the worst and preparing for the worst and hoping for the best kind of scenario.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's program as we continue our coronavirus COVID-19 coverage, what you can do outdoors. Earlier this week, we spoke with someone from the Pennsylvania State Police, but now the state is weighing in. Actually, they have a press conference today talking about what you can do outdoors at state parks, on trails, that kind of thing. And we'll be having that discussion tomorrow, so be sure to tune in. Our guest today is Dr. David Gasparak, Vice President and Regional Medical Director with WellSpan Medical Group, answering your coronavirus COVID-19 questions. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at @SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Ryan in Lancaster. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me, Scott.
Yes, you're welcome.
I was wondering if a family member were to be hospitalized and they get to a point where they're unable to make medical decisions for themselves, and the family doesn't have something like a power of attorney in place. How is the family supposed to handle that during this time?
Thank you for your call, Ryan. Doctor, can you answer that question?
Yeah, these are tough situations to talk about, but you know, it's going to go to whoever the next power of attorney is. So if it's a husband, it would be the wife's decision. If it's a widow, it would be the children's decision. What we're trying to do now, one of our strategies is to have these conversations with all of our patients now, thinking, you know, trying to, again, prepare for the worst. And I would make that recommendation to anyone listening today. If you haven't had that conversation with your husband or wife or had that conversation with your children, now is the time. Get those forms, get everything documented so that if your family gets to that unfortunate point, then they're not going to have to struggle with these questions. Make all your wishes known now.
And I will add to that, it gives me an opportunity to promote something we have coming up on one of our programs next week. I think on Monday, but I'll check to be sure, where we will have someone on talking about living wills, talking about advanced directives, also talking about wills themselves. So that will be coming up on a Smart Talk program next week. Doctor, we have an email from a listener who wants to know the influence of inflammation on the disease. What we eat, drink, alcohol, how much we eat can cause inflammation in our body. Why aren't people talking about diet, nutrition in more detail with regard to protecting ourselves from the disease?
Yeah, I agree. It's true. You know, as you're talking about how we can stay safe and how we can prevent ourselves from getting sick and having complications, all of the basics come back into play. You know, getting enough sleep, exercising, eating healthy, taking vitamins. All of those things do help reduce inflammation. And, you know, historically, inflammation would lead to things like heart attacks and strokes. But in this case, that inflammation can lead to complications of COVID. So I wholeheartedly agree that all of those basics, I would call them, are still important. At this point, I think the focus is still trying to come out with medication that can treat the virus and vaccines that can help prevent the spread of the virus.
Yeah, there is, for so many illnesses and conditions, there is no quick magic bullet. It is a healthy lifestyle and just doing what you mentioned, the basics of a healthy diet, sleep, which we've just in the last few years have heard so much emphasis on, getting a good amount of sleep and exercise. But the thing about it is, as you just said, doctor, that you know, we're looking for some kind of vaccine right now or way to treat this, because unfortunately, if you are obese or if you do have diabetes, you can't just turn that around overnight. It does take some time to develop a healthier lifestyle. Let's see. Susan asks, I've read that the side effects of having been on a ventilator may include organ failure and long-term lung scarring. Could you please address this?
So, yeah, I mean, there are potential side effects and potential complications with being on a ventilator. But when you get into these situations, it's always a cost-benefit analysis. We don't intubate people unless they truly need to be intubated. It's a life-or-death decision. And so at that point, yes, there could be some potential side effects from being on the ventilator, but the flip side of that is the only thing that would keep you alive at that point.
Let's take a phone call from Carter in Lancaster. Carter, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for doing all of these questions. The question that I have is, why are so many tests coming back negative? Looking at Pennsylvania numbers, you can see that without taking into consideration the outstanding tests who do not have the results back yet, we could have up to 90% of Pennsylvania's tests coming back negative. And looking at surrounding states, that number isn't as high, but it's still so high, like 75%. And this is especially when, even to just get tested, you have to meet so many different checkpoints. You either have to have very specific symptoms or be exposed to someone who's already tested positive. So with that filter already in place, because not everyone can get tested, why are the negatives so high?
Dr. Gasparek, what about that?
Yeah, so I think we're still at a point where we're trying to understand the true prevalence of the coronavirus in our society right now. I'm looking at the DOH numbers right now, and you're right. As of today, it's about 100,000 that have been tested, and about 16,000 came back positive, so about 16% positive, which, to be honest, is even higher than the numbers we're seeing within WellSpan. And I can't talk to testing availability outside of WellSpan, but within, we still have tests available. And as I mentioned earlier, the criteria to get tested at this point are pretty light. Just a fever alone, any fever, even without upper respiratory symptoms, would qualify you to get a test. And personally, I think that's why we're seeing so many negatives, is because we have relaxed the criteria to get a test. So I personally think that now that we have more tests available, we're going to start to see that percent positive number even go down further, which is kind of a good thing.
But the point that she makes, that Carter makes, is a good one. When you say that WellSpan, you have enough tests. Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is that what you meant, that you do have enough tests right now?
So tests on hand, that's one of the key performance indicators that we're following on a daily basis, how many tests we have on hand. And it's something that we have had on hand to date. We have not reached a point where we have a shortage of tests, and it doesn't look like we're going to have a shortage of tests.
Okay, so my question then was, there are some places around the country, I mean, New York, that was hit so hard, at first especially, they were not getting the tests in some of these places around the country. They weren't available. And so I guess the question is, were some of those tests wasted on people who have, so many who have tested negative for the coronavirus?
Yeah, it's hard to say. And, we're facing this on a daily basis where health systems across the country are all vying for the same resources. Right now in South Central Pennsylvania, we're focusing on ventilators. The problem is the ventilators that we're hoping to acquire are the same ventilators that are needed in New York City right now. So it's that internal struggle that we fight with all the time. We want to be prepared to take care of our neighbors and our patients in our community, but we also realize the struggles that are going on in other parts of the country. Mm.
Peter asks, I work in the water well industry, working with UV lights that kill off bacteria in private water systems, and it kills germs and bacteria on surfaces. What about an X-ray to kill off the virus in the body?
I haven't seen anything about X-rays to kill off viruses in the body. I have seen, and we're actually using, some of the UV light to kill off the virus particles. So I've seen it used with masks. So you know that masks and personal protective equipment is a hot topic right now, that we're trying to conserve as much PPE, as they call it, as we can. And we use the UV lights at the end of the day in some scenarios to help decontaminate that PPE. I've also seen it on emails where at the end of the shift, some people will stand on a device that gives UV light to the bottom of the shoes, and therefore any bacteria on the bottom of the shoes will be killed before leaving the facility. So there is some truth to the UV light decontaminating surfaces. I have not heard of it being used as a treatment of a patient.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me, though, is that as we are looking for treatment, as we are looking for a vaccine, a way to fight off this virus, this illness, that so many people are coming up with ideas that maybe on the surface, people are saying, well, that wouldn't work. But then you hear a little bit more about it, so, well, maybe there's something to that that could go into a treatment or something down the road.
Absolutely.
Our guest today, if you're just tuning in, is Dr. David Gasparak, Vice President and Regional Medical Director with WellSpan Medical Group, answering your COVID-19 coronavirus questions. 1-800-729-7532 is the phone number to call. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Leslie from Harrisburg asks, are you and other health care systems in central Pennsylvania observing a disproportionately higher number of cases in people of color?
We have not gotten into that level of detail yet. I, like many, like Leslie, have apparently seen some of the news releases, but I have not been able to see any of our data or the Department of Health data that would substantiate that.
I know that there have been calls for more information, more demographic information, so that we would have an idea. But, for example, yesterday in New York came out that 34% of those who have tested positive were Latino. I believe the numbers were in the mid to upper 20% of African Americans. And people are trying to explain why that is happening, but some of it does go back to what you were talking about earlier with some of those diabetic hypertension questions. Plus, you know, there's some other factors like access to insurance, access to health care, probably a lot of reasons that go into it. But that's one aspect of this that will be investigated a lot further, I'm sure. Pam asks, if you have the virus, how long does it usually last?
So first we'll talk about there's an incubation period. So there's an CDC estimates incubation period is about 2 to 14 days, meaning that if you come in contact with someone who is a known positive, you could develop symptoms anywhere from 2 to 14 days. About 80% of those who become infected will have mild symptoms for about a week and then recover. So in most cases, I would say it's about a week of symptoms.
And Jim asks something that's related to that. What is the first symptom?
It's varying at this point. We've seen the most common, like I said, are fever, cough, and shortness of breath. Those are the big three. I saw the Department of Health just today, I think, added on diarrhea as a fourth symptom. We've heard of what's called anosmia, which is the loss of sense of smell. That has been a presenting symptom for some. So it really varies person to person.
I'll follow up with that in just a moment. Let's go to Bruce in Lancaster. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My question is, I believe that that COVID-19 isn't skin transferred. So I'm wondering if there's any benefit to wearing gloves. You know, does it help or nothing at all?
So the way it would help is, COVID-19 is mainly spread between people who are in close contact with one another, usually within about 6 feet, and that's through the respiratory droplets produced when an infected person coughs or sneezes. But it's also possible to get COVID by touching a surface or an object that has the virus and then touching your own mouth, your own nose, or possibly your eyes. So I say all that because the way gloves can be helpful is if when you're out and about, like I said, at the grocery store or at the gas station, if you wear gloves, and then before either getting back in your car or definitely before touching your face, you remove those gloves, then that bacteria, the virus, particles, droplets that are on the gloves would then be thrown away rather than being transferred to the steering wheel of your car or, you know, onto your face.
But gloves themselves, I mean, that's not a 100% protection against this, right? I mean, just what you've described with taking them off and transferring it, you know, just because you have gloves on does not mean you're 100% protected if you continue to touch surfaces, right?
No. And, you know, we've all seen that. I saw it recently at the grocery store where the person behind me had gloves and a mask on, but then they were, you know, touching the cart with gloves on and then readjusting their mask and scratching their nose with the gloves on. And no, that offers no protection. If you're going to wear gloves, you need to keep your hands away from your face and then remove the gloves and throw them out.
You know, I have to say, Dr. Gasparek, that I never realized how much I touch my face until this whole thing.
I know. It's hard. You know, now we're doing Zoom meetings and you see everybody's face on the screen, and you can sit there and count the number of times in 20 minutes someone will touch their face.
Yeah. I mean, I've actually seen, like, people leaning on their elbow or, you know, something like that, or, you know, having their hand up near their face, and I wanted to say, hey, get your hand away from your face. Of course, I'm doing the same thing. So, you know, now, you know, the question I was going to ask before when we were talking about symptoms, you said about cough being a symptom. We've heard that it is a dry cough. As opposed to a productive cough. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, it's really tough right now, like I said before, especially because it's allergy season. A lot of us get congested and get a cough during this time. And like I said, the symptoms vary so much from case to case. I will say, in general, they're calling it a dry cough, not like a deep, hacking cough productive of thick mucus, but it's going to vary case to case. That's why at this point, new onset cough alone, regardless of what the cough is, that is one of the criteria to be tested.
Yeah, even if it is a dry cough, you still are coughing out droplets, right?
That's correct.
Marty asks, he actually has three questions. Please give specific nutritional guidelines to promote, support, and sustain healthy immunity.
that's a tough one. That's a broad one. You know, it's sticking with your fruits and vegetables. It's avoiding the processed foods. It's avoiding the carbohydrates and sugars that can contribute to that inflammation that we talked about before. So it's the old traditional healthy diet. It's the non-fatty proteins and then your fruits and vegetables.
He asked, are there any minerals that prohibit corona from entering the body? I think I can answer that one myself, but probably not. But at the same time, minerals that would help the immune system.
I don't know if you're talking about minerals like vitamin C. Vitamin C does help promote immunity, and we've seen that it's being used in some of the hospitals, even inpatient. We've also heard about zinc recently being added on for treatment. Zinc has historically, it's in the over-the-counter medicine Coldies. When you start to develop some sort of upper respiratory infection, you start taking that. It's a zinc lozenge, and that can help boost immunity in the short term to help fight disease. So zinc and vitamin C are the only two that I'm really aware of at this point.
You know, yesterday we had one of the doctors on, the researchers from University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, that was talking about the vaccine that they're working on right now. And he mentioned that a cold, a common cold, which there isn't just one common cold, is actually a coronavirus. You don't know how many people I've heard since that show talk about that the cold is a coronavirus.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. You know, so we run a viral respiratory panel as a common test that we do, especially in kids, and the coronavirus has been part of that respiratory panel for years. This coronavirus, the COVID-19, it's a novel coronavirus, meaning it's a new strain that we haven't previously identified in humans.
Marty's final question is, does a properly made fitted HEPA filter mask give 100% protection?
So properly fitted would be the key. So you'll see in the hospitals, most people are wearing a standard surgical mask, but some will be wearing what's called an N95 mask. And those N95 masks have to be properly fitted around each individual's face, and then they need to be fit tested. So the only way to ensure that the mask is offering you protection is if you go through one of those fit testing procedures.
Do you have enough N95 NASC right now in WellSpan?
At this point, we have enough, and we're going through strategies daily to try and preserve them.
Where are you getting them?
To be honest, I'm not sure, Scott.
Well, it's good that they're still coming. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on the coronavirus COVID-19, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Yes, WellSpan Health is one of the sponsors of that. Our guest is Dr. David Gasparek, who is Vice President and Regional Medical Director with WellSpan Medical Group. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Rich from Camp Hill asks, if we can convince everyone to wear a mask in public, is it still necessary to stay 6 feet apart?
I think a combination of both makes the most sense. You know, there is some guidance that says if you're maintaining 6 foot distance away from each other, that a mask is not necessary. But then there's other guidance that says 6 feet isn't enough, it's 9 feet. And then, you know, when you're out and about, it's hard to really maintain that 6 feet of distance, 9 feet of distance, and it's really hard to estimate at times. And even if you're doing the best you can, sometimes you'll see someone sneak up behind you in line that's only 2 feet away. So it's really a combination of both, wearing the mask to be to try and keep people around you safe, and then maintaining 6 feet of distance as much as possible.
Bob from Lititz asks, given that people may have been exposed to the coronavirus and remain asymptomatic or become immune, is there currently a test available to determine whether one has built up an immunity to the disease?
Right, and that's one of the hot topics right now. So we have the ability to check antibodies on many of the viruses out there. So, you know, the chickenpox, MMR, those are old viruses that we now have the ability to check antibodies. We're not at that point yet for COVID-19, but that's a daily conversation that these tests are developing. And once that happens, it would be a huge strategy for, especially for healthcare systems, to be able to test all employees and to know which of those employees have already mounted an immunity to the virus.
And that is something that is going on, some testing and actually some treatment around the country of plasma from those who have already had the virus, that they would build up, that would provide some immunity to some other patients. And here's a question along those lines. Hello, as a former blood banker, I have a technical question. I'm thinking about the vaccine that is being developed from plasma collected from recovered COVID-19 patients. Does donor blood type of these recovered patients have any impact? Type AB plasma is the universal donor type. Recipients of all blood types may receive type AB plasma, but type AB donors are relatively rare. What about blood type?
I'll be honest, Guy. I haven't heard the specifics about the vaccination or the blood type yet. I mean, everything you just said makes perfect sense, and the AB blood type is much rarer, and that may be a hurdle we have to overcome when we're developing that vaccine.
You know, there was a news story, and there have been so many news stories in the last 5 weeks, but just about 2 weeks into this, that. I think this came out of New York, that they were finding that there was a certain blood type that was less susceptible to COVID-19 than others. But I've heard nothing at all since then about it, and I don't think it got a lot of traction. So maybe there was nothing to it at all. But there was a story about that. Jim asked, I was wondering why the lupus and malaria drug is becoming very hard to get. The first rule for doctors is do no harm. Are doctors prescribing this drug to anxious patients on this basis, even though it's not authorized for this use, and in fact is warned against? I have to admit, this is a question I've asked myself because I have a friend who has not been able to get his medication. He suffers from rheumatism arthritis and has not been able to get it, or it's been difficult for him to get his medication because this is being prescribed by doctors across the country.
Yeah, and I think there was an initial little bit of a surge when people started to hear that hydroxychloroquine was not only found to be a possible treatment, but it was also found to be helpful prophylactically, meaning that you could take the hydroxychloroquine at a lower dose, and it would prevent you from catching the virus. We saw some of that initially. There has been no mandate nationally that physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, that they can't prescribe this medicine. They're free to prescribe just as they would any other medication. I mean, what I can say within WellSpan is we've been running a report daily to see which of our prescribers are prescribing hydroxychloroquine and ensuring that it's only for appropriate cases, like lupus. You mentioned lupus before. So we're at least within WellSpan, we're making sure that it's not being prescribed for other uses. We're only using the hydroxychloroquine as necessary in the inpatient setting.
Why would doctors prescribe it, though, if it is not has not been proven to work for COVID-19?
Right. So, I mean, it's not proven. There have been no studies. We're not at that point. But there is a lot of anecdotal evidence out there to support that it's showing some benefit with fairly minimal side effects. I mean, side effects, when they happen, yes, are serious. But they're happening. They seem to be happening at a very low rate.
Let's take a phone call from Nancy in Greencastle. Nancy in Greencastle. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi. I heard a week or so ago about a company in Colorado that was going to test the entire population, I think it was in Telluride, for the antibody, and I was wondering if the results of that have been released or anything, or if you know. Thank you.
Thank you. Doctor, have you heard about that?
Thank you, Nancy, for that question. No, I have not. I think that's it would be interesting to follow up and to see how many of those patients had symptoms, how many developed immunity without actually developing severe symptoms. I mean, it's going to be great data to see, and I'll personally follow up on that.
We have a question from AC who asks, I have a question about social distancing within a household. I live with my spouse. Does hugging or kissing a spouse increase risk? How about sleeping in the same bed?
So being around your spouse, yes, direct person-to-person contact, that's going to put you at risk for COVID-19. And we're seeing this where a spouse may test positive, and the recommendation is when your spouse tests positive that you need to self-isolate in the home, meaning that you should stay in a different room, you should use a different bathroom, you shouldn't be using the utensils in the kitchen. So yes, home contacts, there's a high likelihood of spread.
You realize, of course, that there's hundreds of people now who won't be touching their spouse tonight.
Please don't blame me for that.
Okay, I was going to say, you're kind of like the anti-St. Valentine or something like that. A listener asks, my son-in-law is a doctor at Baylor University. He tells me that the COVID-19 test has a 30% false negative rate. Is that a concern? And you touched on this a little bit earlier.
Yeah, and he's correct. It is a 30% false negative. One of the things that we found that lowers that percentage and makes the test slightly more accurate is to only test those that have symptoms. So initially, people were being tested even just based on exposure, and we found that if you were tested too early before you developed symptoms, there was a higher chance that test would come back as a false negative. They're trying to decrease the rate of the false negative test with these newer tests that are coming out, but unfortunately she's correct that is the correct rate at this point.
Frank asks, if China's numbers of infected are going down, what medicines are they using? Are we using the same? How does the global community share treatment ideas?
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to learn as much as we can from China. You know, there's been some question about the data that's being released, but we are trying to learn from what's being done there, but also from what's being done in our own country. So, you know, we have been fortunate here in South Central Pennsylvania that we're able to learn that from what has worked over in Seattle, what's working in New York City, and trying to develop best practices as best we can based on their experiences.
During this whole thing, Doctor, is your health system cooperating or in more contact with other health systems than you normally would be?
Yeah, it's really been a great thing to see. Health systems like WellSpan, like UPMC, like Lancaster General, UPenn, coming together to realize that this isn't about our health system anymore. This isn't about the competition. This is about taking care of people and pooling resources where necessary, really working together, taking the pride out of the equation and just saying, we're here to serve you. Whether it's from WellSpan or UPMC or LGH, you know, we're here. So it's something I haven't seen before. And if we're looking for something positive to come out of this virus, I would say that's one of the things.
We have a fairly long email, and I don't know if I have time to get to the whole thing, but someone providing some advice on inflammation he talked about earlier. Some of the foods that people began hoarding when all this began are the same kinds of consumables that cause inflammation in the body. High sugar foods, artificial trans fats, like found in processed foods, excessive alcohol, processed meat. Keep in mind that foods that fight inflammation are fruits and vegetables, whole grains, plant-based proteins, fatty fish, and fresh herbs and spices. So, that kind of goes along the lines of what Dr. Gasparak was talking about a little bit earlier. Alexis asks, does suffering from allergies make you more susceptible to getting COVID or to having complications if you contract it?
Allergies, no. Allergies is a different immune-mediated response. It would be asthma or underlying emphysema. It was more of an underlying lung condition that would be a risk factor for complications from COVID, not allergies.
Yeah, but isn't, and again, I'm not questioning, disagreeing with you, but it kind of goes back to the pneumonia question. If you were suffering from allergies and you're sneezing, you're coughing, you're not feeling well, your immune system is not in tip-top shape at that point, is it?
True. And then, like I said, I don't think we have all the data back yet to be able to say, you know, which of these is truly an underlying risk factor.
Mm. Galen from Mannheim says some of the minerals and vitamins can be overdone. Zinc is one of them, I believe. As with everything, you can overdo it, right?
True. And, you know, most of the minerals are, you get to a point, and if you take too much, it just passes out through your urine. So there's really no harm, with zinc being one of them, vitamin C being one of them. So, yes, I mean, you want to stick to what is recommended, a recommended daily dose by the FDA.
I don't know whether you can answer this one, doctor, but Sarah asks, is it safe to use public laundry facilities with cold water without worrying about passing or catching the virus? How safe is using laundry?
As long as you're using detergent, whether it's cold water or hot water, should be okay. And I can say that just based on what we're recommending for washing these homemade masks now. It is just washing them in your washer at home with normal detergent. The issue about using the public laundry is just droplets that could live on the outside of surfaces to make sure that you're disinfecting surfaces before you use them, maybe using gloves and taking them off before touching your face, that kind of thing.
And really, whether it's a laundromat or any other place in public, I mean, the same kind of rules apply, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. We have some open phones right now and about 3 minutes left in the program if you'd like to get an email or a question in for Dr. Gasparak. 1-800-729-7532. We'll try to squeeze another call or two in, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Doctor, I have to admit that, we've been doing this now for the last 5 weeks where we've had a medical professional like yourself on at least once a week. 5 weeks into this, it's still, I don't know, I still find it fascinating that there are so many questions, some of them so basic, with so much information out there. And it makes me wonder whether it actually confuses people sometimes. What do you think?
Well, Scott, honestly, I think the whole situation is still surreal for so many people, including myself. It's hard to believe that our lives have been changed this much. It's hard to even imagine the possibilities of what this could look like in 3 weeks. So it's hard for us to process. And I think it has this underlying level of anxiety that, you know, we want to do everything we can to try and be safe. We want to make sure we're doing the right thing. So we're questioning everything at this point. And that's why I think we need to remain calm. We need to remain patient. We need to work together to beat this thing.
Mm. So you said something that one of the good things that's come out of this is the cooperation amongst the health systems and not thinking about competition. Do you think that's something that will last? And maybe I should ask the question, just broaden the question. When we are through this, there obviously will be some changes in life. What kind of changes do you think we'll see?
I mean, the cooperation I've seen between the health systems, I've also seen that in the communities. We've seen many community people in the community, restaurants, coffee shops, bringing things to WellSpan, making donations to WellSpan, showing their support. I see people reaching out to neighbors that, you know, may be high risk and can't get out of the house and may not be able to do their own grocery shopping. I see people really working together to focus on what's important. You know, when you get to a point like this with a pandemic of massive proportions, it really helps put things in perspective. And I'm hoping that will continue even after we get past this.
Dr. David Gasparak is Vice President and Regional Medical Director with WellSpan Medical Group. Dr. Gasparak, thank you very much, and hopefully you won't lose your voice today after talking for an hour straight.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much for all the work that you're doing. Coming up on tomorrow's program, again, one of the biggest questions that we have had is when it is safe to go outdoors, where you can go outdoors. Can you go to a hiking trail? What about driving to the trailhead? The State Department of Natural Resources, Conservation of Natural Resources, DCNR, will be having a press conference later today, and we will have someone from DCNR on the program tomorrow. Also hear about a couple communities and what they're doing to help those that are in need right now. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.